I started to learn and become aware of what sort of in the back of my head I knew. You know, I knew there are Christians all over the world and that the churches, especially in Africa, were just booming as far as membership and growth. I'd heard that. But I paid no professional attention to it. It didn't figure in what I did when I did my teaching. And after I just went through this little blue book, like most professors, I said, oh, now I know something, I'll offer a seminar. And so I did for the first summer school that came thereafter. And ever since then, I've been teaching and learning the theology, not really third world theology, but I've limited myself to Asia and Africa. Because lots of folks are doing liberation theology, Latin and South America stuff, and you know, I've paid some attention to that and try to keep a little bit in touch. But an even bigger unknown quantity for American Christians is what's going on in Africa and Asia in terms of what the people are doing, first just the church life, but the fact that they're doing education and seminaries and lay theological institutes and everything. And generally folks here, as far as I know, at least this one, didn't know anything about that. Just pass the books around in case anybody just wants to, you know, thumb through to look at the table of contents or whatever. So the upshot of that is that through my colleagues nudging, I've now gotten more involved in the missiological world. That's a fancy word for the science and study of missions. That doesn't mean, as you probably, some of you probably know, what we folks who got the gospel do for them who don't. But missions is wherever Christians are in the world, and you know that part of the world is full of them, doing the word and will and work of the Lord to keep the good news going and growing elsewhere. So people talk now about missions to all six continents. And perhaps some of you even run into some Asian or Africans who are missionaries to America. You know, what sassiness. Okay, I've now been 1, 2, 3 times in a piece of the Asian or African world, and within this past year, I was for 3 weeks in Eastern Asia, Japan, Korea, Manila, and the Philippines. And in that case, and in that instance, visiting Seminex-like communities in Asia. And I'm going to try to do a little about on that next week, if some of you are still around and are still interested. This was my first visit to Africa right after Christmas this year, and I was there for 3 weeks, so I'm now an expert. But drawn by the fact that an international association that I now belong to, IAMS, International Association for Mission Studies, had its every three-year conference this year in Harare, Zimbabwe, which on some of your older maps will be Salisbury, Rhodesia. That conference lasted a whole week. I gave a paper at that conference, a piece of which is going to be the last half of our hour this morning. And that paper reflected some of the things that I thought I'd learned in the last 5, 6, 7 years, and I called it Lessons for Western Christians from African Christologies. That's, you know, highfalutin language, but Africans who have worked on what does the picture, what does the reality of Jesus mean, and specifically, how can we make it more winsome, make it good news, so that it's really good and it is something new. Because I had that chance and had that big expense of the big ticket, perhaps on the middle map you can see the red lines, that's my route down and back, I took another 2 weeks before the conference. The conference was the middle of January. And so right after Christmas I left St. Louis and went all the way to Johannesburg and right away over to Namibia, which is this corner here. I did about a week in Namibia exclusively with the Lutherans there at their seminary out in the bush, landed with the airplane at Windhoek, which is the capital, and then 120 miles out into the bush by car with a friend of mine who came from the seminary to pick me up and go out there. Perhaps you know that Namibia is the old German Southwest Africa colony from before the First World War. And when Germany lost the First World War, they lost all their African colonies. They also had Tanganyika, which is now Tanzania, over in East Africa. So they had a piece of West Africa and a piece of East Africa. But the German culture persists. You go into Windhoek and you think you're going into a Bavarian town because the signs are still in German. Even black people speak German to you. But after the First World War, Namibia became a protectorate under South Africa. And South Africa has never given it up. Although in the last 10 or 15 years now, UN resolutions over and over again say you were given the protectorate so that you could facilitate independent democratic elections so they could become their own governors and self-governed people. The vast majority of Namibians are Christians, and the vast majority of those Christians are Lutherans, because it was a German colony, and so the German Lutheran missionaries missionized it. There's only one seminary in Namibia, and that's in this bush town called Otjimbingwa. And that's then where all the Namibian national, the blacks, go for seminary if they've got any kind of either Lutheran or just general Protestant connection. There's a small Anglican community here and there, and a few Roman Catholics, but it's one of the most Lutheran countries in the world. That's so strange. Okay, I was a week in Namibia, and then I came back to South Africa and stayed a week in South Africa being exposed. That was the fancy word they used. We had a, quote, exposure experience. All of us who came to that conference in Zimbabwe were asked, especially if we were foreigners, Westerners like myself, come a week early if you can, and we'll arrange, quote, exposure experiences for you with the Christians here so that you get a little flavor of it at least for a week before you come up to the conference and we all have our, you know, international get-together. And my exposure experience, since I was lucky or blessed or graced to get a visa into South Africa, I thought, you know, with my connections, you know, they know me at Holden, I'd probably say, you know, thumbs down. But no, I got a visa anyhow. And I was with a new, relatively new group of Christians in South Africa. Their center is at Johannesburg. Everything's at Johannesburg as far as it's the New York City, but it's not the administrative or the legislative or the judicial capital. The capital, South Africa has three capitals. Cape Town, I've forgotten which. Cape Town, I think, is the legislative capital. That's where the Congress and the House of Representatives are. Pretoria is the administrative capital. You know, that's where the Prime Minister is. And then halfway in between is what? Bramfontein, which is the judicial capital. That's where the Supreme Court sits. And those three cities are sort of major cities in the, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, or is it 5 provinces that make up South Africa. So in Johannesburg, for about a week, the people who now call themselves the Confessing Church of South Africa, they took that, it's said in Afrikaans, Belydende Kring, which means sort of confessing group or confessing circle. They took that name from what happened 50 years ago in Nazi Germany, where the Confessing Church pulled itself together, folks who were in the other churches, but who were aware that Hitler's incursion into church government and church administration, that Hitler was appointing the bishops and wangling elections, and above all pushing the so-called Aryan Clause, which said no non-Aryan dare have a civil service job. And in the German system, pastors came under civil service law, and so in the middle 30s, pastors who had even just a strand of Jewish heredity to them were illegal, where they were peeled off of the pastorate. And that was one of the things that was a hot potato around which the Confessing Church gathered. Well, so there's a confessing movement in all of the Dutch Reformed churches. There are four major Dutch Reformed churches, and the divisions are all by the racial distinctions, because the government says everything is racially apartheid, separated. So there's a white Dutch Reformed Church, there's a black Dutch Reformed Church, there's a colored Dutch Reformed Church, those are people of mixed racial heritage, and then there's an Indian, or I guess they just call it Indian, or Asian Dutch Reformed Church. We met members from all of these who are together in this confessing church group or confessing circle, And they just drove us around to different places and to talk with different people for most of a week in Johannesburg. I then went to Pretoria. I've got a short line here. I guess I can't get it over there. Yeah, that'll help some, but I'll... Went to Pretoria and then took a... with some friends of mine who were going to the same conference, African people, white Africans, and we then drove 1,000 kilometers from Johannesburg on the ground up to Harare, Zimbabwe, in a big fat Mercedes. So I was living like a Western affluent capitalist again. And saw, you know, huge baobab trees, which of course I'd never seen before, but only had read about in Saint-Exupéry's Le Petit Prince. And then for a week I was at this conference, which was really a who's who of Asia and African theologians, most of whom people in America, even theologians in America, have never heard of. But these people are the equivalents of the Paul Tillichs and the Reinhold Niebuhrs, if those names mean anything to you, and the church leaders like, you know, Crumley and David Preuss, the people who really are leaders there. And we had this week-long conference. I gave a paper, you know, there's lots of papers, and to that extent it was a typical Western egghead conference. But the president of the nation of Zimbabwe was one of our main speakers, who has a very strange name, and most Americans laugh, so I won't tell you. Canaan Banana. He's a Methodist, ordained Methodist pastor, who's now the president of Zimbabwe. The prime minister is Robert Mugabe, and you hear about him more often in the paper, and his conflict with Nkoma, the leader of the two main groups of tribal groups that make up Zimbabwe. On the last Sunday that I was in Zimbabwe, I went down to Bulawayo, which is sort of like the Chicago. If Harare is the big city, New York, Bulawayo is the other big city. And that's where the Ndebele, the other tribal group, that's their general set. I mean, they're in the south and the west. And there I preached at a service where one of my Seminex students, a black, an Ndebele guy himself, was the pastor. I should tell you about that. It was all translated, of course, into the African language. And when the service was over, and if you had been there, oh, I got some pictures. Well, I got some, all I got is photographs. I don't have slides. I'll send them around anyhow. Just start peeling them off and passing them down. But you know, you can look at them. If you had been at the service, except for the fact that it was in a language most of you probably couldn't have understood, you'd have said, this looks like a very Lutheran service. The pastor had on an alb and a stole, and the altar was, you know, where it ought to be, and the church looked like, well, you'll see some pictures of it. And that's not surprising, because Swedish Lutherans missionized this part of what at that time was the British colony of Rhodesia. And so it's like little Sweden as far as the architecture goes. And some of those folks still speak Swedish, too. So the service is over, and I and the pastor file out and stand at the door. And I notice that as people come by and shake my hand, they go outside the door, and you'll see some of the pictures. And like I say, here's the door. And the first one stands here, and the next person comes out, shakes his hand, and stands here. The next person comes out and shakes his and her hand and stands there. And before, by the time everybody's out, there were about 300, we had this huge circle all the way around in front of the church. And then, you know, I thought, oh, well, okay, now it's over. Everybody's shaking everybody's hand. Everybody go home. Oh, no, they don't. Pretty soon, the drums, which had been the only music we had inside the church for the church service, not the only music, the only instruments we had, the music was just sort of a cappella led by women who picked up the theme, who just started singing, and everybody joined in. They had no hymn books. Wait a minute, they did have hymn books, but they weren't using them. Every now and then, my student pastor translator would flip the hymn book open and say, it's that one, see if you can read these words. And they're written in English characters, so after a little while I could make the sounds close. But the drums pick up then outside in this big circle, and the evangelist in that congregation, he's a man in a brown suit. You'll see him standing sort of inside the circle a little bit on some of the pictures. Starts doing something, and pretty soon the drums pick up, and women start singing, and the whole group is singing. And I elbow my buddy student and say, Lobi Sifobella is his name. I say, Lobi, what's going on? And he said, well, you probably, it'll surprise you, but they're taking themes from your sermon, composing free verse songs to them, and now the women are starting to get out there and start dancing. And I said, gee, it was never like that in St. Louis. maybe just one more thing of this sort of little Ed Schrader's Africa Journal, and then we'll get to the other half of the assigned topic. Africa Journal, a picture of Jesus Christ from Botswana. Now, what was the one more thing I wanted to say? Gee, my Alzheimer's disease is catching up with me. Where was I?
You were dancing.
Dancing? It was never like this in St. Louis. Well, it wasn't.
What else did they do? How long did
that last? Maybe half an hour or so, and then finally they broke away, and it was, you know, 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock, and folks moved out to go home for lunch or supper or dinner or whatever. But this too, even though Zimbabwe has now had independence for going on 5-6 years, and therefore there is no racial discrimination as part of the policy which it had been under English rule, because of the economic situation, blacks still live in the old black ghettos because they are too poor to move into anything better, although there's some very, very spiffy homes and houses in Bulawayo for the weekend that I was there. In fact, this student of mine, who's an operator, just recently bought one of these ancient mansions, 2 acres, swimming pool, and garden, and all over, for $25,000. And I said, that, you know, that sounds cheap to an American, but that's a big pile of bucks for you, Lobi. How'd you do that? How are you doing that? And he said, well, I'm still a student. He's finishing his doctorate's degree, of all places, in Hamburg, Germany. And by now, June, he should be done and be back home. But he was there over the Christmas holidays, and I was there shortly, early in January. Yeah. He said, we've had a small house in, you know, the black, fairly far out of town. And we had to go on a bus to get to this place out of Bulawayo, maybe, you know, 10, 15 miles, although it's sort of part of greater Bulawayo. Njube was the name of this town, N-J-U-B-E, with an accent there. He said, we've had this home, and I'm now renting it out for $145 a month to somebody else. And on this home, I'm only paying $150 a month mortgage. So for $5 a month, he's buying himself a mansion. But he's the only black in the neighborhood so far. And economic things are very tough all over Africa, but also in Zimbabwe. The socialism doesn't work any better than capitalism does in many of the other countries. And so Lobi told me, he says, you know, we're a prime target for black attack, just because, you know, now, you know, we look like honkies since we're living here. And he was somewhat, as was his wife, apprehensive of him, you know, going 12,000 miles north to get to finish his doctorate and leaving her and the kids there alone. Oh, I know what I wanted to say. Back at the conference, I said we had the president of the nation of Zimbabwe speak to us, Canaan Banana. And he made a pitch for Christian socialism. He says, what we got going here, I think, and what I'm trying to do, is not Marxist socialism, but Christian socialism. And that's an accent that I heard in other places as well. They said, Marx gives us insights into how economic oppression works. And for us, that's almost just a fact. That'd be almost like trying to argue to say, is water H2O or isn't it? You know, that's not ideology so much as just an aha of how things work. And we're trying to make it a Christian socialism. And then he took the rest of his speech to spell that out, which I won't do for you here. If you're interested, I think I got the lecture along here someplace. The blacks that we met in, well, we met blacks, coloreds, whites, and Indians in South Africa, people from all of the four branches of the Dutch Reformed Church. I met a few Lutherans, but not many, because these Dutch Reformed confessing church folks were our hosts, and we were with them. I got in on Desmond Tutu's news conference just after he got the Nobel Peace Prize and came to Johannesburg. Part of our exposure experience was to be there for that. We had a long session with Byers Naudé, who's now Tutu's successor as chairman, general secretary of the South African Council of Churches. And we met and were lectured to and had discussions with many of the people who are prominent leaders in the church and theology of South Africa. One of the people we met is Frank Chikane. I think his picture's on the next batch.
How did the South Africans
No, I don't have it.
How did they
handle? They who?
The South Africans.
Well, there are black South Africans, there are colored South Africans, there are white. Well, you know about as much about that as I do, almost, just from the general image that you've been given through the media, especially after Kennedy is being there right at the same time we were. We prepared the way for it. Frankly, one of the facts is that we never talked flat out, you know, to a pro-apartheid Afrikaner, although we were getting that all the time, you know, in the newspapers. That's what I could ship out for you. Unfold some of these and just pass them around. These are just clippings from the newspapers for the week we were in Johannesburg. Some of them are about Tutu getting the Peace Prize. Some of them are about Ted Kennedy being there. I think it's on the other side. Yeah, this was welcome for, is that Kennedy? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Perhaps the best thing I can indicate, if you remember, was how did white America treat and receive Martin Luther King? You know, eventually somebody assassinated him, although it's still not clear as far as I know what that was. Tutu is really a Martin Luther King type, I think, who says nonviolent direct action. That was the Martin Luther King motto from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And in my way of understanding that, that's the way he was both Christian and political. Direct action means we put political pressure, economic pressure, we use the courts, we use public opinion, we use all the things, to take Lutheran language, we use all the things that God's left-hand regime has available for justice and for preservation of life. But the unique place where God's right-hand kingdom of Christ impacts is that we are committed to be nonviolent, you know, to shed nobody's blood. And perhaps if you remember from the days of the 60s, I didn't know until I studied a little bit, what kind of discipline training the SCLC, King's Outfit, did when they did marches. If someone said, you know, I think if Bull Connor hits me, I'll pull out a gun and shoot him, then King said, sorry, you can't be in the march. Well, Tutu, I think, is that kind of person. In fact, I assumed press credentials and asked him a question. I said, I'm from this little dinky outfit called Seminex, and we got a little newspaper called Lutheran Perspective, and those are my credentials. And I asked him about the Martin Luther King connection. And he said, yes, I think so, but with this one difference. In America, the blacks were fighting for the rights that technically were already on the books in the Constitution. But in our case, that's not yet true. We are literally non-persons. All blacks are non-persons in the South African government. And so we have to fight just to get ourselves to be persons. Imagine that. I'm 53 years old, I got a PhD, and I'm an archbishop, and I can't even vote in my own country. Okay. We met some very angry blacks who said, you know, it's too late. There's going to be war, and it's just going to be blood. Some of those were Christian, some were non-Christian. Most all the Christian people we met, not most, a large number were, I guess I'd say, in and around the Tutu camp in terms of their perspective. But there's a lot of parallels, I think, to the American black movement For example, King himself got radically criticized by radical blacks as the movement went on, the black nationalists, and in some cases even the black Muslims, who said, you know, Whitey's the devil, kill him. And there are blacks in South Africa who talk like that, and we read their papers. Some of the articles in some of these papers report that. Okay, it's a very complicated thing, and I probably don't know more than you do, although I know some people that I didn't know before, and I've got it, you know, firsthand, and I've lived there for a few days and felt it. More than that, probably I don't have. Especially in the last several months here in America, where the media and the have been bringing an awful lot of South Africa here. Ted Koppel's thing a month or two ago of Nightline, and the things that are going on at African embassies and universities, students and faculty protesting, somehow disinvestment, all those things. So I think American media are giving you, you know, giving us a lot of the data, more so obviously than a lot of Africa, South Africans have, either blacks or whites. For example, when Ted Koppel had Bota and, was it Bota and Tutu, you know, on split screen, but simultaneously arguing with each other, you know, nobody in South Africa ever saw that or ever saw that before in normal daily life, and they didn't see that program either. But I digress.
I'm not sure now. I'm looking to see what it says. You can sort of tell by reading how an article gets presented. Take one of these sheets and pass it down.
I have one quick question.
Yes, sir.
I read once that by 1900 they estimated that 90% of all black people in the United States had some white blood in them. Would the black people that are in the United States today be considered colored in South Africa? Would they fall into that category?
My understanding is that colored are folks for whom it's more obvious, at least than it is to me, that they've got mixed race. And the mixed is not necessarily just white and black. A lot of it's black and Indian, and black and other Asians. You know, South Africa isn't too far away from India. I don't have the whole globe on there, but there's an awful lot of ancient communication and trade from India to South, in fact, to all of East Africa. There's Asians, Indians all the way up and down the coast who have been there for generations. And some of that is in the mix. I don't know technically what one has to be to be pegged colored.
This is South Africa. The distance from here to here is about 1,000 miles. The distance from here to here is about 700 or 800. So it's about like the United States east of the Mississippi, and then cut off a fairly big chunk. That's the ballpark figure. I think it's more than half of the state, the United States east of the Mississippi. But it's not as big as organization. That's at least a frame of reference to get a feel for its size. Namibia, you've got about half of Namibia on here. Namibia is having this much more, and it's not too much smaller territorially than South Africa. There are only a little over 1 million people that live here, because it's almost all territory except up north, where you've got a more lush vegetation and climate. B, about here is where the equator runs. Botswana is this piece of land here that's almost totally desert, and the capital is Gaborone. Just this last week, South African military marched into Gaborone to destroy some African National
Congress.
African National Congress, yeah, which are the liberated black political group here. Which is technically outlawed, I mean factually outlawed, and so many of the people are either over here in Mozambique or here in Botswana, you know, planning someday to return and liberate their homeland. The same is true over here in Namibia. There is the popular SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization. Most all the SWAPO people are Lutherans, just because that's why we got there, but they are now also illegal, and so some of them are in Angola, and others are in Botswana, over here in Zambia, and what's farther up there. I've never met this author, Gabriel Setiluane, but he's a Botswanan, and at the time he wrote that, he was in Gaborone, which is right on the border of South Africa, although it's the capital, because I think most of the Botswanans live right here, and the rest is the Great Kalahari Desert. The Kalahari Desert also goes into northern Namibia, and that's one of the reasons why very few folks live there. Did any of you see this sort of ambiguous movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, The Gods Must Be Crazy is set in Botswana. Mm-hmm. So the turf you saw there is Botswanan territory. Let's read this thing Bible class-wise. Even it's got some big, strange words in. I'll help you, maybe. I don't know if I can say them any better. And just sort of read a kind of a verse or so at a time. Figure out where you think the verse ends and bump the next person. Because I want you to read these four pages, and then I'll talk about it a little bit. Paul, would you start? No, let's just start with the poem, since I'm running out of time.
Black is my father, and his before him, as my mother and sisters and brothers, living and gone from this world. Right here.
They ask me what I believe, my faith. Some even think I have none, but live like the beasts of the field.
Okay, the they he's talking about is Westerners, folks like us. Next, please.
What of God, the people? Revealed to mankind through the Jews of old, the Yahweh I am.
Read the next two lines. That's still part of it. This is a Westerner asking Setiluane, what about the God of the Old Testament?
Who has been and ever shall be? Do you acknowledge him?
And then comes his answer.
My father and theirs, many generations before, knew him. They bowed the knee to him. But many names they knew him. By many names they knew him. And yet says he, the one and only God. They called him...
Here's my guess. Uvilingki. That's a click sound, I was told.
The first one. He came here ever... Came here ever...
The first... The name... apparently Uvilingki means... The first one who came ere ever anything appeared. You know, when there was still nothing around here, this deity was on the scene. That sounds like, you know, Yahweh was brooding over the chaos before anything was put in shape. And here's another one. Unku lonku lu. It's really a double. Once you get the first two syllables out, you can just go to the next one. Unku lonku lu, which means...
The big one. So big indeed that no space could ever contain.
And then I guess Modimo, that's another name.
Because his abode is far up in the sky. They also knew him as
Modiri, or Modiri.
For he has made all. And Uresa, the spirit without which the breath of man cannot be.
One thing I learned in South Africa, in Southern Africa, in fact, I learned this over at Namibia. I did a trial run of this paper I was going to give in Zimbabwe 2 weeks earlier when I was at the seminary, the Lutheran seminary. Well, this is it. This is that Lutheran seminary. That's how I put the shirt on. You'd never guess that this is the T-shirt of the Namibian seminary out in the bush, Otjimbingwa, Namibia. Because it looks like, you know, at least an American seminary, or if you know, no Americans even use Latin words anymore, but Germans do, and so Paulinum, United Lutheran Theological Seminary, and then he's got a Latin motto here. No, Christ is our peace. That shows just how, you know, sort of German culture still persists at that seminary. There isn't a Namibian word on it. Okay, I gave this paper at that seminary, did a trial run with the faculty, and they told me, you know, all of these words are not really proper names, like the word Yahweh is, so, you know, our God's proper name, or like the name Tom, Joe, Fred, or Sally, or like Zeus. But he said, these are really just normal words in the language, you know, everyday nickel words that just describe what that God's supposed to be doing. And so, unkulunkulu means the big, big one, so big you couldn't even get him in any, you know, confined space. And the word uvilingaki means the first one, somebody who came before anything was around.
And Modimo means the one who lives way up in the sky. And Modiri means whoever made everything. And Lisa means the spirit that makes that puts breath into people. But those are, if you will, they're common nouns, not proper nouns. And I didn't know that until these Africans told me that. Okay, would you please continue? Yeah, that's for the reprint's getting very fuzzy, I know. He's asking me two questions. You know, what about the God of the Old Testament? And what about this Jesus of the New Testament? Would you pick it up in the back next row, please? Okay, let me intercept here. He starts by his answer to the question about, you know, Jesus. Have you guys had any contact or belief in him? And he said, for ages this Jesus eluded us, and he asked for a way down here in Botswana. Because this Jesus, you know, who comes from, well, here's Palestine, if you go on this sort of politically organized map. This Jesus went first to Asia, you know, up this way, where Paul, missionary journeys up here, Asia Minor and there, and then on to Europe. You know, Paul went, the Macedonian call took Paul to Europe, and that's probably why Luke features it in the Acts of the Apostles, that's a continental jump. And then on, you know, the Christian community grew in our direction, finally, over here to North America. So he says, this Jesus eluded us. For some reason, we never got connection, because at first he went that way. And then some say he did try to come to us, sending his old messengers, but they were cut off by the desert and the great mountains of Ethiopia. So there is an ancient Ethiopian, you know, Coptic church that you've probably even heard about, that goes apparently way back to apostolic times, or at least it sure seems like it. They think it has, and they've got, you know, documents that go way back. So the desert, you know, Jesus went sort of across the northern country. This became Christian, the Mediterranean basin. But the Sahara kept Jesus from getting to us, and the mountains over here kept him from coming in this way. But wanderers from behind those mountains, every now and then somebody from over there did come across, and the message kind of trickled down. You know, way down here is 3,000 miles from here. It's a fur piece. Africa is a huge, huge continent. But they were strange tales they told to our fathers, and they in turn to others. Tales of this man of Bethlehem who went about doing good. But the theme of his truths is now lost. You know, just what that was all about and how that all computed never stuck here, south of the Sahara and west of the Ethiopian mountains. And about the best we got left is that mothers would rock their kids to sleep with some Jesus words or something that they'd picked up, but that was about the gist of it. In other words, if you might say, Jesus' first move to us way down here, bombed. He never made it. Didn't get here. Okay, now, second time. Would you pick it up again?
Yes, please.
Later on, he came, the Son of Man, like a child delayed, he came to us. The white man brought him, He was pale and not the sunburst son of the desert.
Okay, then came the Western missionaries, Europeans and Americans, and of course the Jesus they brought was a white Jesus, a white baby Jesus, in the pictures and in the fact that these white people, us, you know, think of our Lord like us, if he was incarnate for ourselves. But that's not very much like us blacks yet, at least just visually. But then he goes on.
A wee little babe wrapped in swaddling clothes. If only he had been my brother Moses, lying sun-scorched on the banks of the River of God, we would have recognized him. He eludes us still as Jesus, Son of Man.
Okay, he compares. He said, you know, if he'd just been like Moses. Remember, Moses was an African. I don't know if you remember that.
Sunday school.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Egypt is Africa. And Satilwane thinks he was black African. You know, sun-scorched like I am. If he had been like that, if Jesus had, you know, been that kind of a Moses person, you know, that would have clicked. But he wasn't. He was pale. He wasn't this sunburnt son of the desert. He came as a child. But then he goes on to say that he eludes us still. You know, even the missionary Jesus still eludes us, at least up until very recently, or at least until we caught on to what he's now going to tell you.
His words, ah, they taste so good, as sweet and refreshing as the sap of the palm, raised and nourished on African soil. The truths of his words are for all men, for all time.
Okay, the words of Jesus, the Jesus message, that's very African. You know, that resonates with us. But the Jesus picture still doesn't. But now he says, he moves farther in the next one to say, it isn't just that he was white instead of black, because that's, we're not so dumb either. We know that that's superficial. But here's where the real difference was. We didn't get much of the Jesus that's now going to be described in what the missionaries brought us. And now I want to tell you about that.
And yet for us it is one who is on the cross, the Jesus of Nazareth, with folded hands and open eyes like a priest at a sacrifice. When he was stripped naked like us, browned in sweating water and blood, and the heat of the sun, yet signs that we cannot resist.
So, the theology of the cross, to just use a little technical Western jargon, the picture of God's mercy and the crucified Jesus, that, says Brother Gabriel, that grabs us that we cannot resist him. The other two, remember, where he eludes us still. He eludes us still. But this one doesn't because, well, he'll tell you more.
How like us he is, this Jesus of Nazareth, beaten, tortured, imprisoned, spat upon. I don't know that word. Truncheoned.
That means billy clubbed.
Truncheoned, denied by his own, and chased like a thief in the night, despised and rejected like a dog that has fleas for no reason.
Next.
No reason but that he was son of his father. Or was there a reason?
Yeah, he's saying, you know, for no reason, I just got, you know, stupid, dumb, blah, blah, blah. And then he starts reflecting, oh, was there a reason? And then he goes on.
There was indeed. As in that sheep or goat we offer in sacrifice, quiet and uncomplaining, its blood falling to the ground to cleanse it as us, and making peace between us and our fathers long passed away. He is that lamb. His blood cleanses not only us, not only the clan, not only the tribe, but all mankind. Black and white and brown and red. All men.
Ho, Jesus Lord, Son of Man and Son of God, make peace with your blood and sweat and suffering with God. You say the words a lot better than that.
Now on my lips are dry. Uviling haki unku lunku lu.
For the sins of mankind, the fathers and men, standing in the same sonship with all mankind of you, together with you, we can pray to him about the Father and forgive.
What do you hear there as a lesson or maybe even a gift for us Western Christians from this African brother? This, even this Jesus picture, but what'd you say first, Sarah? I didn't hear that. Okay, he's obviously not using inclusive language, and maybe for some of us we got to translate that even to get to feel more at home with it, but you can do that. What about the Jesus picture itself? That was sort of my focus. the Christ picture he proposes, but just sort of lays in front of us and says why that one clicked when the other is still eluded. Yeah.
I think it was because this Jesus was, maybe he was, in the scriptures, he was proclaimed kind of a godly king, but in reality, he was beaten, tortured, kicked around, put on a cross to die, just like we have been beaten, kicked around, enslaved by the same people who brought this Jesus to us.
Mm-hmm. That's a very powerful point, I think. And you hear that all over in Africa. All over. I haven't been all over. I've heard it frequently, and you find it in the literature. By the way, these three or four books I'm passing around are three or four of maybe 300 or 400 like that that are already printed and out on the market. I've only got a small fraction of African Asian theology, and I got two big bookshelves full already. And that's just all, from the last 10 years or so. There's really a humongous, almost a reformation, a renaissance, and it's a very mixed bag of all sorts of, left and right and center and angry or not so angry and whatnot. But one of the accents is the very one that Satilwane's poem here signals. It's not to say, to hell with Jesus, we're going to go our own way, but to say the Jesus, either that you guys brought or somehow the one that we picked up, maybe you didn't intend to bring it, was a Jesus who was a colonialist. Or that. Or he was your kind of Jesus, and you guys were always in charge. And we were never in charge. We were always under you. Even when we had benign colonial administration, we were still, at the bottom of the totem pole. And this Jesus obviously was your kind of person because A, you brought him, and B, you said you believed in him. So we thought, Jesus is the one for successful people, for the winners, not the losers, for the folks who are top dog, not underdog. And then he then says, draws the contrast, the crucified Jesus. If that's really the Jesus in the New Testament, and then the little twist is, So tell me about your Jesus, you Western white folks. Is your Jesus this kind of victorious, always on top? Is he the real Jesus or isn't he? Is he the real New Testament Jesus? And if he isn't, or if at least it's shaded an awful lot by your framing it, how do you folks handle this truncheon, crucified, beaten like a dog Jesus? Is he good news for you? Because I tell you how he's good news for us. Fred, you were saying? I saw a hand. I'm still looking for, or listening for, anything you might want to say in response to this.
The blacks in our history and the free speech movement were the only two that I could see that happened within our country where there was a massive amount of people who were oppressed. And yet our country is a top dog country in the world. So maybe that's why they were trying to, validify why they...
Okay, let me try to just take that and push it a little closer to home. Is there anything in here that you could use in your own home congregation for the rest of 1985? Either share it or what? Is there anything in here that's worth taking home? That's really what I'm asking. Not just because you say, well, Schrader expects us to. I'll see if I can come up with something. But, if you yourself say, now that I think about it, that might be very helpful for us here in our parish at that point, or somewhere, or in our synod, or in the, not necessarily parish, in my group of folks, or the Christian, or even the non-Christian clique I hang around with. Yes?
We have a Kenyan connection. The
Kenyan connection. How alliterate.
We just finished building, literally. We sent one of our instructors, our contractors, spent winter season, which is fairly low season, and got the Maasai tribesmen to build a church.
Here is Kenya, where my lines bend, because I went in and out of Nairobi on the plane down with KLM. So there's Kenya.
And we're currently in the process of trying to, they have asked us to build another church. We're trying to raise funds to go back and build another church in Kenya. So our congregation is very much personally involved with Kenyans. We've had a number of people come over, several people we have supported and are supporting to get education in the United States and return back to Africa. So I'm about to invite you to come speak to our congregation.
Well, anyway, yes. I'm a 3-week expert. Other comments? Even if it's not on my question or my what I'm pushing. Anything in this poem from Set Tilawane that you'd like to respond to? Cameron.
I guess I've been looking in all spring at the different picture that all third world countries have, especially Latin America. But it sounds very similar. And I deal with that with people trying to get them to understand that the realities that we experience at least us to a picture of Jesus who ministers to us in certain ways is quite radically different from the picture that other people must have of him in order to take him as their own. And I don't really know what that means for us except for an understanding that the needs of the South half of the world perhaps more than liberation from the personal sins that we feel like we experience and loneliness and all of that, the needs that they have are so strong and so physical that they identify with the God who feels of that same suffering and can work with that and change that. So I don't know exactly what that means except for just an awareness of the difference in pictures that people have of him.
Does Brother Gabriel sound to you like a political radical, maybe even a Marxist? You know, just from these four stanzas or these four pages.
Political radical change.
Here, let me really be radical. I think it's radically theological, and you probably do too in this sense, in that I've heard in the 2 weeks I've been at Holden a good deal of God talk that never gets beyond question number one. Sort of what I call, you know, sort of generic God talk about spirit and power and the divine, as though apparently that's enough for folks to live and cope with. In his case, at least, he says, that wasn't enough, isn't enough for our people. Even with such great statements as, not statements, but experiences. You know, all of these descriptive names are experience descriptions. You know, we had this experience of some power that was the first one who came or anything appeared. We have this experience of Unkulunkulu, some power so big that, you know, we can't figure out how it all fits into the space available. Modimo, some power that's really far above and beyond us. Modiri, some perception that we didn't make this world, but somebody else did. And then Leza, that spirit that we wouldn't have life if some power somewhere hadn't, you know, blown air into us. Now, I hope you catch, or if you didn't, you may on second reading, that these are almost step-by-step pieces of the way the Old Testament describes the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's not complete, because, well, let me ask you, a little session here. What's missing in this first list that Brother Gabriel said he and his people never got in their experience with Yahweh under these names? What's missing that Abraham did get besides all of that? Yeah. Okay, relationship and, well, you talk about it rather than me interpret you.
Leave his premier's land, and you know that he—it's that personal relationship of God saying, taking him and moving him and being with him.
Okay, I sense that too.
The God in relationship to man.
Right. The one thing I've got underlined just at the end of that first question and answer, that none should reach his presence unless they die. The only way you could get contact with this whole deity collection is first you yourself had to die. That the ancestors who are dead somehow have, you know, a connection. But that's a strange way to run a railroad, you know, to say, I'll have relationship with you, first die. That the living can have no direct connection with the God. And that's exactly the opposite of what the whole Old Testament story is.